This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by one of my favorite sponsors, Sunset Lake Sabada. SunsetLakeSabada.com. You can use code LEFTISBEST for 20% off. Sunset Lake has all sorts of amazing Sabada products, like tinctures with melatonin. They have gummy bears, smokables, fudge, coffee, hand lotion, salve with arnica. And not only that, you can be sure of the integrity of these products. They have third-party analysis of their CBD on their website.
They send you a dossier. At least they send me it.
Yeah, no, I get one too. It really is. Like, I look through it and
I feel like I stumbled on some trade secrets.
Exactly. They also have great agricultural practices. They practice regenerative farming in conjunction with the University of Vermont so that they're taking care of the soil. They use integrated pest management so they don't have to use any pesticides. They use 100% organic fertilizer. It's a great product. They're also a great business in terms of their business practices, $15 minimum wage, mostly employee-owned company, and their movement partners. They support strikers at the hospital in St. Vincent's Nurses in Worcester. They contribute to organizations in and around Burlington, Vermont, where they're from. They also helped us out big time with the Afghan refugee money that we raised, over $30,000 for three separate organizations. On top of which, we're planning another a fundraiser with them in the coming weeks. Just a fantastic operation. And also, did I mention the smokables, the Smalls, the Keef?
Smalls and Keef.
Make for great gifts. And also, I mean, it's been a huge boon to my sleeping. And occasionally, when the kids get a little bit much, sometimes I'll lean on a little tincture or, you know.
Go nuts.
Or a gummy bear. I'm not kidding.
Those,
you know,
gummy bears taste amazing.
Yes, you got to be careful with those. Yes. And the fudge. That's a real problem for me because I have my sweet tooth. I got to stay away from stuff like that or I'm going to be in a vegetative state by the end of eat the entire fudge. Folks, check it out. SunsetLakeSabada.com. Use the code LEFTISBEST. One word. They wanted to use that, longtime fans of the show, for 20% off. And speaking of the show, let's start it now.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, November 5th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, staff writer at the New Republic, operator of the AP Substack, and also co-host of the Politics of Everything podcast, Alex Perrine will be joining us. Then, later in the program, proprietor of the Matthew Film Guy box. What is that called? Box? Where he puts the films? Box? Something?
Letterbox?
Letterbox? And also the Langdon Boom eBay sales store. Matthew Film Guy will be here with us. Meanwhile, I just got a comment about my exposed neck. House is attempting to vote on the bipartisan and the reconciliation bills as we speak. No word as to whether that's actually going to happen. Meanwhile, the tax portion of that bill, the reconciliation bill, amended to protect millionaire and billionaire tax scams.
Of course.
Replaced with a higher nicotine tax.
Oh, we are in 1972.
The Biden administration considers vaccine mandates for companies with less than 100 employees in the wake of getting more specific on the requirements for companies with over 100 employees. Meanwhile, Republican governors look to sue the administration in a hope to prolong the pandemic. Preliminary results on a Pfizer anti-COVID pill show that if taken within 3 days of diagnosis, it reduces hospitalization by 90%. New York cabbies end their hunger strike and have won debt forgiveness on their medallions. Meanwhile, national job numbers top 530,000, well above expectations. In addition, we've seen upward revisements on job numbers over the past 3 or 4 months. Lastly, Carper, the most recent senator to the latest filibuster holdout to endorse a workaround for voting rights. Stay tuned. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is a casual Friday, and as Judy Rudigliani has said on the IM, I have an uncovered neck. I am
second
Emma Vigeland.
Casual Friday in a row.
It's the second... It's like the first thing you said to me today.
I was just shocked. The neck, it's so there.
Yeah.
It's right in front of me.
Yep. We've seen the Majority Report data analysis crew got back to me after last week and said that we had a 2.7% rise in viewership.
Oh, because
when it became clear that I was not wearing a soft collared collar, but rather no collar. That 5% more flesh actually increased our ratings significantly. So,
well, soon, yeah. You know, we're going to do V-neck, then deep V-neck.
Yep.
Then return to a tank top only show.
That's right. We'll be fully tank topped.
And that'll be a sight to behold in wintertime.
Yep. Yep. You know what the problem is? It's just my soft collared shirts, like I only have one and it's getting, I got to get a new one.
What's it getting?
It's just getting old. Like it's starting to like fray.
Ah.
And
okay.
I thought
we were going to hear something about a smell, but.
No, I washed them.
Yeah. Allegedly.
No, I'm pretty good about that. My son has a different problem though. He doesn't. Never mind.
Okay.
This Pfizer anti-COVID pill is interesting. There are a couple more of these. I mean, we've heard of other things that have been helpful. Fluvoxine, I think, has been something that has been treated. But Merck supposedly had a
antiviral pill.
This one, they literally had to stop the test because it was unethical to give people in the test a placebo. Apparently, when you have a test for a drug and the drug is working that well within the context of a test, it becomes unethical to continue the test and provide placebo. This is what the now before you get too carried away with this. This is Pfizer's releasing of their own data. Now, this is the way it works. I don't know if people realize this, but the FDA just takes the data from the companies and just makes sure that they're, you know, that the way they've done the results lines up. But I think regardless of whether it ends up being a Pfizer pill or Merck pill, or they find some other existing medication, we are very close to what looks like the end game. Between the vaccinations and this, these type of therapies, we are very close. And the reason why this therapy is different from, let's say, monoclonal antibodies, that is, you know, hugely expensive. And you need to be in a hospital to get them. This is something that you would take if you got diagnosed, if you took it within 3 days. And they've only had, I guess, you know, about 700, 800 people who are in this trial. 389 people who got Paxlovid after 3 days, within 3 days of getting diagnosed, there were 3 hospitalizations and no deaths. 385 people who got the placebo, there were 27 hospitalizations and 7 deaths. And so they had to stop the trial for those ethical considerations. They also did a study of another 1,200 patients to start taking the treatment or placebo within 5 days after symptoms. 41 patients were hospitalized or died in the placebo group. And far less in the other group. I don't have the specific numbers, but it was 85% within 5 days. And so when you combine the reduction that you would see from vaccination and then the ability to take a pill, and I think there are other pills in development, we're getting to the end game where this is simply endemic. And we are having children between 5 and 11. I already know some kids in my son's playgroup who already got vaccinated. They just went down to City Point down.
Wow.
And just walk in. So we are getting very, very close to what the end game is, which is it's endemic and we're living with it. And apparently the notion about these pills is that the assumption, or at least the understanding at this point, is that they are variant agnostic, that they're dealing with and that means that where a vaccine may have a specific ability to stop a COVID variant or a lack of an ability to stop a COVID variant, this treatment is broad enough that the variants probably wouldn't make a difference. So,
I mean, that's exciting. I'm so technology illiterate. I wouldn't understand why that would be the case, but.
Well, that's it. I mean, I would imagine it's just sort of like it's dealing with symptoms and the, you know, what these, the way that the spike proteins react. It's one thing to prevent, you know, a certain type of intrusion, I guess, into your body. It's another to treat what the implications are once it gets there.
Right.
But you know, this reality is going to influence our conversation with, or have impact with our conversation with Perrine about what we saw this week and, what the midterms are looking like, et cetera, et cetera. In the meantime, as we speak, there is an attempt, and it's unclear to me whether it's actually going to happen. But the House Democrats were planning to vote today on both the Build Back Better bill and the bipartisan infrastructure bill. And it's unclear if it's going to happen, but they're attempting to do it. And meanwhile, Joe Manchin still providing all sorts of fodder for attacking him. He, you know, like all of us, you can't just teleport to your your yacht houseboat.
Yeah.
You need to get there in some fashion.
Not yet, anyway. They're working on the technology.
He does not have a helipad, folks. So he's going to get there either through public transportation or he's going to take a private vehicle. And in this instance, he took a private vehicle. It is his, what is it called?
A Maserati.
A Maserati Levant.
A Levant?
Yeah.
What makes that different than other Maseratis?
Don't want handouts, folks. Yeah.
It's sort of a mix between the giant luxury sedan and an SUV. So it's
one of those Maserati SUVs I've heard about.
Yeah, if you want a luxury car but also want it to be a gas-guzzling SUV.
Yeah, two for.
Let's, and apparently some activists, basically gave him a little send-off.
They must have confused it for their Maserati.
The aspect of the Maserati Levant is its great ability to back up. You can see from that, the handling, particularly when you're reversing, very, very,
very smooth. It looked it.
Very smooth.
Yeah.
And you'll notice in that course, and folks, you don't try this at home. There are pillars there on the left, and that could have created some problems for the Maserati.
Joe Manchin is a professional driver.
Yeah,
and I am sure that the rear view camera is crystal clear.
We're going to talk more about this with Alex, but I do not remember any of this with Joe Lieberman or with those who were sort of pumping the brakes during the ACA battle,
like Stupak.
Yeah,
Bart Stupak, like was he the abortion guy from?
Oh
Michigan?
Yeah, but that was from Michigan. That was in the House, but it was really Backus and Lieberman, and I think Evan Bayh, and some of these guys who were really interfering with the better provisions of the ACA, and I just don't remember this kind of like organized activism and isolation of these guys. I mean, it'll be interesting. I don't know what kind of impact it's going to have, but at least it's.
I mean, I think it speaks to where the left is now than versus where the left is then. I mean, we can get depressed about the state of the left now, and I think that's fair, but still significantly in better shape.
And just general awareness about this stuff.
Right.
Exactly.
And who the villains are.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to Alex Perrine. Folks, we got three sponsors, three other sponsors aside from our Sunset Lake buddies today. Yes. First off, 530,000 people hired. Upward revision on other numbers. We'll talk to Perrine more about this, but that means you've got gyms and nail salons and hotels and mom and pop stores and more. Set to go on an epic hiring spree in the coming months to meet the pent-up demand for all these services and more. Like I say, Saul and I were walking to school today. Well, he was walking to school. I was walking him to school. And we were talking about what movie we were going to watch tonight because it's Friday night's movie night. And I said, dude, once you get vaccinated, we're going back to a theater.
Mm.
And maybe... because apparently the Eternals came out. I don't know what that is.
Oh, that looks
but look,
terrible.
The bottom line is you get a lot of businesses that are going to be reopening, and that means that millions of jobs are going to need to be filled. So where do these businesses turn to fill these roles fast? ZipRecruiter. It's like the Majority Report did. Bradley's not here today, so I can't tell that story about getting Brendan and then Bradley from that. But right now you can try it for free, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. When you post a job on ZipRecruiter, what happens is they send your job to over 100 job sites, gives you access to their network of millions of job seekers. ZipRecruiter's matching technology scans resumes, find qualified candidates for your open roles, and proactively presents them to you. You can easily review recommended candidates, invite your top choices to apply for your job. And when you invite top choices to apply for your job, you have a better chance of landing them. Because, let's face it, right now, labor has a little bit more power than it has in the past. So you got to impress those people. Right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority, M-A-J-O-R-I-T-Y, majority. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter, it is the smartest way to hire. Meanwhile, scaling your business, as you know, can be very difficult, but it's also a journey of endless possibilities. And Shopify is here to help. They have tools, they have resources, and make it easy for any type of business to succeed from down the street to around the globe. Shopify powers over 1.7 million businesses from first sale to full scale. I know one of these businesses. It's called shop.majorityreportradio.com.
Oh.
Yes. Shopify gives entrepreneurs the resources once reserved for big business. So upstarts, startups, podcasts, established businesses alike can sell everywhere and synchronize online and in-person sales and effortlessly stay informed. With Shopify, you can reach customers online and across social networks with an ever-growing suite of channel integrations and apps. I'm talking Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Pinterest, and more. You synchronize your online and in-person sales and gain insights as you grow with detailed reporting. More than a store, Shopify grows with you. This is possibility, and it is powered by Shopify. The thing I like about Shopify, I mean, obviously it's not our main business, the merchandise, but we come up with a, what a nightmare, Crowder, boom, we can just put it, it's super easy for us to operate the customer-facing interface, as I like to call it, with the, on our merch thing. And I just, this morning, I was like, I texted my sister, and I was like, dude, we should get pencils and pens. And as soon as we get those, boom, we put it right up on the Shopify site. And now you can go to shopify.com/majority, all lowercase, for a free 14-day trial and get full access to Shopify's entire suite of features. Grow your business with Shopify today. Go to shopify.com/majority right now. Shopify.com/majority, all lowercase. Check it out. Lastly, don't know what to give for Hanukkah's early this year. You should know. I mean, I don't know why you should know. But you're not Jewish.
I know.
Christmas, apparently, same time every year. That's yes. One of the things I've found out from working with so many Gentiles.
Right.
It's wow. same time.
Not same day of the week.
Mid-20s, I think it is,
yeah,
in December.
Somewhere around that.
Anyways,
yeah.
What are you going to give your family and friends? Same old boring gift?
Hope not.
Nope. I got a new gift for you to give. You ready?
Okay. Yeah, a new one?
The Hello Tushy Bidet.
I knew it.
Yep. Checks all the boxes. It's useful, but definitely unique. High-tech, but definitely affordable. Plus, eco-friendly and, frankly, life-changing.
Mm-hmm.
Hello Tushy Bidet cleans your butt way better than wiping, and it cuts toilet paper use down by 80%. Washes your bum with fresh water for a better clean. You just spray and pat dry. You don't need a plumber. You don't need any new electricity. Hello Tushy conveniently attaches to your toilet in under 8 minutes. The complete Tushy system turns your restroom into your best room. Got some great copywriters there. With the Tushy Bidet attachment, they have ottoman, toilet brush, and Tushy stand and tissues. Join the millions of happy butts falling in love with Hello Tushy. Look, honestly, you could change someone's life with this. This is like one of those things. Like, you do it, and most people do it every day.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't really think about it because there's only been one way that you've been doing it your whole life. And then all of a sudden, something radical happens. And
what do? You say to your loved one, hey, I think your ass is dirty. Here's what I'm going to get for
no,
you for
it's
Christmas.
Like, this is something, a lot of people just like the concept of doing it, I think there's a big bar to entry. And that's what
you
makes
eliminate
this,
that bar to entry.
That's what makes this such a great gift in my, yes. in my estimation. It's something that most people would not think to get them themselves. It is also not nearly as expensive as you think it is. Super easy to attach to the toilet. And it can be life-changing. And then they think about you every day. Man, I don't know if it did necessarily.
Yeah, it'll be a positive.
I mean, it's not a romantic gift, but it could be. I guess yeah. It could be, too. I don't know. Look, the bottom line is give the gift of a clean butt to yourself or to your loved ones this holiday season and get 10% off plus free shipping right now at hellotushy.com/majority. That's hellotushy.com/majority for 10% off and free shipping. Don't forget to tag Hello Tushy on social to celebrate your clean bum. All right, let's bring in Alex Perrine. He is the staff writer from the New Republic. He is the proprietor of the AP, the good AP. That is the medium. And, of course, the co-host of The Politics of Everything. Alex Perrine, wonderful to see you again. Of course, Emma's here.
Hello, Sam. Hello, Emma.
Casual
Hello,
Friday.
Alex.
I hope you're not too thrown off by my lack of a soft collar.
Yeah. It's a little striking. It was not the picture I expected to see.
Well, there you go. You know, it freaked you out a little bit. Dude, let's start with, I mean, we obviously have a lot to talk about this week. Really depressing week in many respects. But why are you being so obtuse? Let's just start with that, okay? Because, and I'm talking about, and you probably know what I'm talking about for folks who don't know. One, you're subtweeting me last night, I noticed. I'm just going to read the first of the tweets. An intellectual whose work I've read admiringly and who I am very confident now, maybe a lot of people use.
Yeah, Sam thinks you can read YouTube.
Speech-to-text program.
That's true, yeah.
Speech-to-text program.
Sam wrote an
stuff.
Audiobook just like Meghan McCain.
And who I'm very confident is much smarter than I, and I wanted to just say, don't be so confident about that, Alex. Has once again run aground on the obvious reject wokeness response of, quote, who precisely is supposed to do what precisely to whom and by what mechanism that will work. And then you're writing, as far as I can tell, and like, again, being obtuse about the Build Back Better bill. And but you refer to it as pizza. And
yes.
All right. So let's start with the first thing where you were subtweeting me about and presumably this is really in the wake of Terry McAuliffe losing in Virginia. And, you know, Virginia being a bit of a disaster. In New Jersey, it turns out that Murphy's going to win by close to 3 points, less than people thought. Also, the first time, apparently, since 1977 that a New Jersey governor got reelected.
No, a Democrat.
A Democratic New Jersey governor got reelected.
Isn't that amazing?
Is amazing.
You had, like, the McGovern scandals and stuff.
Yeah,
yeah.
But still. And so, you know... And before we get into that, just that point too, Eric Levitz had a piece that was basically, well, we'll get to that in a minute, but part of that just sort of outlined the general picture, right? I mean, it's an off year election, first year, of a new president. Virginia governor almost always loses if their, president's in power, but there was an expectation that McAuliffe was going to win, you know, 6 weeks ago.
Yeah.
So, give us your broad perspective on that, and then let's talk about this sort of like reaction. There was one tweet that I saw that said, you know, countdown to Democrats basically coming out and saying we need to get more racist as a way of combating what happened in Virginia.
Well, right. I guess what's interesting is that you have a lot of things that were like any election. Sure. You have a lot of things that were particular to this race and these specific races that were particular to Terry McAuliffe, the candidate. They were particular to his opponent. But at the same time, you describe, if you just gave me the broad outlines, in the sense of like, it's a Virginia governor's race, which are always open races because they have a one term limit, which automatically makes them weird. You look at the history and pretty much like clockwork, Democratic president next year, Virginia has a gubernatorial election that the Democrat loses. Like that just happens over and over and over again. So obviously it's still worth examining why that happens. But I do think now that we're a few days removed from how terrible things felt on Tuesday and Wednesday, it is more apparent, I think, that we just witnessed a lot of sort of normal political reality, like a lot of elections that even if we thought Democrats would have done better a month ago. If we abstract it out, we would have said, oh, yeah, that might actually be tough. And, you know, and there was a lot of money spent in Virginia and but like in New Jersey and, you know, here in New York, like we get the Jersey ads. Right. And I mean, it didn't exactly feel like an overwhelmingly like those midterm cycles when you just are bombarded with ads. Right. It felt like kind of a little sleepy even. And I think like the more interesting result to me is Steve Sweeney getting booted, having not campaigned whatsoever. Like that just suggests something that, to bring this back to actually make a point, like, so was this a referendum on wokeness in public schools in Virginia, or was this just the party in power getting punished by people who are, for a million different reasons, unhappy with things, with how things are going?
And particular people in that party. So McAuliffe couldn't be more of an establishment guy. And then you talk about Steve Sweeney, the Senate president in Jersey, union guy who basically pissed off every union in New Jersey, strayed away from that by leading an effort to cut pension plans in New Jersey. And then he loses his seat to a guy who apparently spent $200.
I did barely. Yeah, that guy who barely had a campaign.
So all of the talking heads saying the rejection of wokeness, which is of course coded rejection of the left, and Tim Kaine blaming the left for holding up the bipartisan infrastructure bill, among other, you know, Mark Warner as well. Like, that's clearly running counter to the realities on the ground here. McAuliffe and then even someone like Sweeney, they were the casualties here, the surprising ones, and they were both as establishment as it gets.
And to get to the point I was trying to make last night, the prescriptive argument for what Democrats are supposed to do loses all meaning when you're talking about a candidate like Terry McAuliffe, right? Like, the entire point of this up until Joe Biden was elected was that we needed Joe Biden's to fight back against the white rejection of Democratic wokeness. We needed people like Joe Biden to be in charge. And then corollary to that would be that instead of someone young, instead of someone exciting, instead of someone progressive, instead of a candidate of color, well, Virginia needs Terry McAuliffe. He won it before. He's an old, safe white guy. Literally, what are we supposed to do? Like, if electing Joe Biden president and nominating Terry McAuliffe was not enough, I think it's hard for me to even understand what additional steps Democrats could take if that is your prescription for what they need to do.
Well, first off, I appreciate you saying this to my face, finally. I think the bottom line is that is not that recipe is not necessarily particularly, you know, the context. It may have been right for Joe Biden last year. I don't know. I'm not necessarily, you know, it's very hard to say, like, what if it was Elizabeth Warren? What if it was Bernie Sanders? What if it was Kamala Harris? It's very difficult to sort of, like, you know, make that assessment. Although I think in a couple of those instances, I probably could make an assessment, but nevertheless, what is interesting to me about, well, there's two things that occur to me, you know, in the wake of this. One is that the establishment and the consultant class much better at spinning a narrative out of something than everybody else, right? I mean, that is, to the extent that they have an ability to do anything, that is what their ability to do is. Like, they were on this, you know, put up this tweet by Tim Kaine. This is pretty astonishing. Well, I guess it is, and it isn't astonishing. But Tim Kaine was out there yesterday, and I guess this guy from, Business Insider wrote this. But here is this, this is a good example. Brian Metzger, I think it's from Business Insider. Tim Kaine tells reporters Democrats in Congress hurt Terry McAuliffe, calls out purist demands on the Build Back Better. I asked him to what extent he faults McAuliffe. quote, you know, there's a million reasons behind Eddie Vickery at loss, but that's not productive right now.
That's the entire dynamic. That's it.
That's really, I mean, touche, right? Like, I mean, you really just have to sort of just say, like, wow, you gotta, I'd like to have seen that kind of balls, frankly, in just about every other thing that you've ever done, Tim Kaine, sort of had juxtaposed those two comments. So that's the first thing that I think is the big takeaway from this, is that, like, they have this narrative ready to go. They keep this on the shelf and they just deploy it when, and, you know, we saw this, you know, in the wake of Clinton's loss too. I mean, this is deployed. We saw this in the wake of the 2020 losses in the House, or lack of gains that we thought, right? It's because of defund the police and blah, 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 whatever it is. The other, I think, thing that strikes me about the McAuliffe election came from this Eric Levitz piece, which is, like you say, if you were to, like, step back and take a 20,000 foot view of this, you'd say, yeah, it's likely whoever runs as a Democrat in Virginia for this governorship is going to lose in this context. But somewhere between whatever that view is, 20,000 foot and down on the ground, theoretically, the fact that this is the party of Trump and everything that goes along with that over the past 5 or 6 years should count for something.
Yeah.
And Levitz writes this piece that says, like, it didn't.
Yeah. They were able to have it both ways.
They were able to sort of appeal on some level to the suburbs. Now, if you look into the numbers, it feels like it's, you know, a big cohort that swung against McAuliffe was white women without college degrees. Mm-hmm. So, you know, white working class women. The numbers in the turnout numbers were good. For both the Democrats and the Republicans, obviously better for the Republicans. But the Democrats, and this is one of those things, like, I don't know, you can make it up in a campaign. They've for the past 6 years have failed miserably. And they certainly failed in 2016 to tie the Republican Party to Donald Trump. And that is just an unforgivable failure, it seems to me, in terms of, like, politics.
Well, it's really funny because it's a failure in two different kind of contradictory ways, right? I think, and it should be very worrying for Democrats, because it's very worrying that this is exactly how it played out. Because I think what happened is that, I assume you saw the mailer that they sent out, right, with Youngkin, that was, like, only mentioned how Donald Trump has endorsed Youngkin, and then, like, it was a Democratic mailer with a big picture of Trump and the Republican candidate saying Donald Trump, you know, and, like, you know, we have talked about Trump's kind of wacky effect on turnout and who turns out and what they vote for. And it seems very hard to, like, nail it down who he turns away and who he attracts. But I think what happened in this case and what could continue happening going forward is that the people who are turned off by him are not convinced by attempts to tie Republicans to Trump, and attempts to tie Republicans to Trump then activate people who like Trump.
Yep. Well, I mean, look, I think the groundwork was not laid to tie them together. In this instance, the Republican, Youngkin ran away from Trump in the general election totally. Mm-hmm. And also benefited from the fact that we are far enough out from 2024 that Donald Trump did not feel compelled to insert himself in the way into elections like he has in the past. And one could at least hope that he will in the future, at least in terms of, like, the midterms. But my concern is that, like, by winning in Virginia, there's going to be a better argument for Trump to stay in the sidelines and do what he did from behind, you know, because this is a guy, obviously, that, you know, it can be told, like, you were the string puller And it's better if you're doing it from behind the curtain and him going like, yes, okay, as long as I get the credit. And that's a real problem for Democrats because they haven't laid the groundwork. I think they couldn't convince people that he was tied to Trump in that way.
And but I mean, there's also the issue of like, okay, tying him to Trump, right? But this is what Democrats refuse to do, right? Is actually make a case against the GOP generally, and not just because look, Trump, like, they enabled him, but like they enabled him, and it's like to actually sort of make a case that you know, the Republican Party itself is irresponsible and can't be trusted with power. They make every race about individual candidates every single time, and I'm sure they have I'm sure they have some reason for that probably is indicated in polling or something, but every single race becomes a story of two individual candidates disconnected from larger parties. And they need to actually learn to tell a story about why you can't trust the Republican Party and not this guy.
Mm-hmm. Right. They need to come up with their version of like, this is Trump University politics or something, you know, something like that, where they're able to sort of like have coded words.
But they're unwilling to do that. You have Pelosi basically saying we need a strong Republican party. That's a dominant viewpoint.
That's the other massive failure is Pelosi saying that they protected Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell in the run up to the 2016 election. And this sort of is a perfect segue into the massive failure that is the Build Back Better bill. And that is Joe Biden, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months after the Republican Party basically ushered in 1,000+ marauders into the Capitol building. And he lets them stroll into the White House to negotiate a bill that every single person involved knew they were never going to be on part of. And so the day that Joe Biden opened up the infrastructure bills, essentially, or bill to Republican input was the day, as far as I'm concerned, that led to whatever debacle we end up with. That is the Build Back Better plan. And why did they do that? Like, what? Like, A, why was there it was almost like they projected onto the American public a desire to have the Republicans return to normal. And it's like, why would you do that? Because you're going to get Virginia if you're basically validating the fact that Republicans are normal and they're not.
Yeah, it's really hard to make the case that Republicans shouldn't be trusted with power in an election. It's when you're trying to win an election and you're trying to convince voters, they should not even consider the Republican candidate. It's hard to make that case when your party is deciding that it cannot pass, that it made the entirely voluntary decision to turn its policy agenda, the president's signature policy agenda, to split it into multiple parts, one of which had to be passed with the support of Republicans. it just doesn't make logical sense. And then to say we need to include them in the governing process, and no one can really explain why. We just need to. There needs to be a part of this that they sign off on. And I think at some level there is obviously a sort of desire on the part of certain establishment Democrats to enable Republicans to hold power in order to stop certain advances they don't want from happening.
Right.
But at the same time, there's also, I think there's a sort of sincere belief in a completely nutty, process by which treating Republicans as normal makes them go back to normal. I actually think that that's actually a sincere.
They want to will them back to.
They want to will them back to 1968 or whatever. You know.
I also think there's a middle ground. I mean, I think there's a third position too. There's no doubt in my mind, and of course, I think both parties do this on some level, where they want the other party to give them cover for things that don't pass. I mean, yeah, in the yeah. same way, there's some people hiding behind Manchin and Sinema to some extent. I don't think they could hide too much. Like Mark Warner may be happy the PRO Act's not there, but had Joe Manchin signed off on the PRO Act and Kristen Sinema, I don't think Mark Warner's going to stick his neck out like Joe Manchin yeah. has on these things. But, and there's no doubt there may have been some impetus to say like, all right, let's bring Republicans in so we can sort of like rough off some of the, you know, sand off some of these rough edges on, you know, what Bernie Sanders wants. And we don't expand the age of Medicare or whatever it is. I mean, I'm not convinced that that's not part of it too. And I do think that there is this notion of like, let's will back to the days of the Senate where, you know, Tip O'Neill and Reagan and, you know, could go out and have a drink after being really mean at each other and, you know, whatever, like, what's his face from Utah and Ted Kennedy can go out and have a, you know, go
or Biden
gallivant with people, you know, whatever it is. Yeah, but I also think that the Biden administration thought, okay, we're going to show the American public that we're putting our arms out and, you know, that we don't really have a partner, you know, in negotiating.
Oh, yeah, totally.
And so there's like that third position where they think they're being smart politically. They think they're appeasing this. They're scratching this itch that the American public has for that sort of, you know, non-bickering between the parties. But I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding of what the American people want. It's not that they want the parties to get along. It's that they don't want to hear any bickering.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And well, the way that you don't hear any bickering,
it's a jam through your agenda.
Jam through your agenda and you just end it. Like that's what the COVID relief bill showed us.
They don't want bipartisanship. What they don't want is dysfunction. That's the number one thing that they'll react to.
They just want drama.
Or drama.
And so this is what rip off the Band-Aid.
And this is what I mean, having a longtime senator president is the worst possible thing because he's enabled the Senate to hijack this entire thing.
Yes.
And senators don't understand that like dysfunction, arguments, things not working, that's just like how the Senate processes things when it gets into this mode that it's been in since spring, right? Yep. And I mean, what you just said.
It's unbelievable what we don't have settled in this Build Back Better bill.
Yeah.
It's nuts.
And I made exactly the point you just made in August, which was that
I made this point in July.
they hadn't even started negotiating with the crucial votes they needed to win passage of this, and because they wasted all this time on this bipartisanship. But like the pointless bipartisanship, like that wasn't just their strategy to the negotiating with Republicans with the expectation those negotiations would fail was not even a voter directed strategy. That was a Manchin and Sinema directed strategy. Like it's nuts.
it's nuts. And all they did was give time for Manchin to have meetings with no labels and for Kristen Sinema to do fundraisers with corporate donors. Yeah. And establish their plans of attack essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, they gave him a lot of time to formulate a way to sabotage the entire thing.
And like, I don't know, like, I really do feel like this failure was 6 months old and, you know, we spent a lot of time saying, you know, it's the second 100 days of the Biden administration where this is going to be resolved. And that's where they really blew it.
Yep.
Right. I mean, it really was like April, May, June, July, where they really blew it. I can't remember when exactly he brought in those Republicans. I think it was around May. Maybe it was June, but that's when they should have put this vote on the floor. That there was no, they had an opportunity to basically, you know, I hate to use this football analogy again. I think I waited for Emma not to be here when I used it last time. But, you know, they were lining up in a, you know, in the hurry up offense and, instead, they just basically said, we're in a hurry-up offense, but wait a second. Let's let the defense get settled because it's got two guys.
Yeah, they have two. Yeah.
the two guys who are still on the sidelines, let the coach decide who they're going to do,
yeah,
and allow the linebackers to decide between themselves who they're going to pick up out
it
of the backfield.
It wouldn't be fair if they were 12 men on the field. Was
I fine. Mean...
Right? It wouldn't be fair to the process.
Dr. Seuss.
Respect the game.
Dr. Seuss. That's what they were talking about when the COVID relief bill passed.
Yeah.
Like the biggest, one of the biggest sort of like bills that we had had
Mr.
in...
Potato Head.
Potato Head, yeah.
And Mr. Potato Head.
We talked about it at the time. I remember it very clearly. They were not getting their footing. They were struggling to find a way to attack Biden, who had just passed that massively popular COVID relief bill, as you say. And then they were like, okay, they finally ended up with critical race theory and all of that. But it took some time, and you could have used that limbo period to do all of this.
I mean, conservatives at the time were freaking out because they had not seen Democrats in array like that. they were worried. They were worried it was a sign that this administration would be different. And like, thanks to the Senate for giving them time to formulate a winning message in Virginia.
Yeah.
Let's just talk about, I mean, since so much of this analysis has been a function of like, what are the implications for the midterms? I am of the mind that the Build Back Better, the passage of the Build Back Better bill was really more about the sort of policy implications than the political implications.
Yeah,
and that, just like the COVID relief bill, like that doesn't seem to have meant anything to anybody. Mm-hmm. And the expiration of the unemployment benefits. I mean, I think like you have a slow degradation and disengagement by the base, which I think it could be very well be very problematic by the midterms. But it also, you know, negative partisanship becomes very important. I think the real thing is going to be really the vaccine mandates and the potential to roll out, I don't know, more at-home testing and, you know, like this Pfizer anti-COVID pill or the Merck one or, you know, some other nameless COVID bill or the vaccinations for kids. Like, that could change everything.
Yeah. I mean, it's as always, it's hard to see in the COVID era. It's like we don't know what the world's gonna look like soon, but I don't know. I think it could be the case where things are back to normal enough and the economy, depending on I think energy prices in large part, but the economy is doing well enough that the election can be held entirely on weightless cultural issues. Like, I actually think that's like a kind of a real possibility I have, which is it's kind of to some extent what happened in Virginia, I think. Like, the things they were talking about had real causes, but it was kind of just like, if the crisis feels mostly done, we can just go back to screaming about nonsense.
But didn't it kind of connect, though, with COVID? I mean, basically what Youngkin was saying was, his final pitch, Fox News op-ed, was, I won't close the schools. This will be over. Basically, he ran on, you're all sick of this, and I'm going to end it.
Yeah, and I think that is... So the conservatives and Republicans have messages for their elite and messages for their base. I think for the Republican base, it's been over for a long time. They're not doing anything. Schools and schools are open in Virginia. So I think that was sort of an elite targeted message.
But then they're able to kind of say like, oh, well, if you elect a Democrat, it might happen again.
Yeah. And- yeah. But I just don't know. I mean, the reason I don't know if that was actually that compelling was because of the California recall, where that didn't work at all. I mean, maybe it was. I could be completely wrong. But the California recall seemed like an attempt to run on that issue above all else. Things will go back to normal. Schools open, won't close them.
California, a bit different, I would say.
Well, no, yeah, totally. Yeah, you're totally right. But yeah.
But aren't we looking at a source of dissatisfaction, right, and of anger, which everybody on some level is feeling?
that Biden spoke to when he ran against Trump.
Yes, which is like, this pandemic has sucked, and then isolating one part that it sucked the most about, which was centered around the idea of schools and kids being at home, right? Because look, if you're in your 20s and your 30s, you are probably the least likely to have felt, broadly speaking, across the country, the problem with this pandemic, right? Because maybe if you don't have kids and you're 20s and you're in the 30s, you're still going out to a large extent.
Yeah.
You can't see your parents or this and that, but like you don't know as many people who have died who are your age. You don't have a maybe rational or maybe irrational fear about what's going to happen with your children. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, to hit the cohort of people who, and particularly, you know, non-college educated, white working class, folks. And although who are at least more open to the Republican message, and particularly in Virginia, it is a combination of, here's the angst. Where are you going to channel that angst? Yeah, well, yeah. Here it is, into a vague second, third order racism. And honestly, like, this is just sort of classic scapegoating. You're unhappy. You're dissatisfied. You're feeling a malaise. Well, here's a scapegoat for you. And that doesn't work as well in California. And that doesn't work as well in New Jersey. And that didn't work in New Hampshire. And in Connecticut, it didn't work in the same way, at least in the, you know, in the suburbs. But Virginia, you know, maybe little bit more open to that idea of scapegoating a certain, you know, cohort of people. And I think that's a big part of it.
Yeah. I think that's right. Yeah.
If it seems to me, we're in a position where COVID is not as big of a deal, that we have normalized to the extent that we can normalize, that kids are going to school and they're not masking up by, you know, the end of next spring. And people are going out and, you know, 98% of the country or 7% of the country is vaccinated or claim they are.
Yeah.
It's going to be a very different midterm, it seems to me.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you know, there's a question too of does Biden go around the country barnstorming saying, I cured COVID. COVID went away because of me. I think that maybe that's a smart thing to do, but I also wonder, does that work? Does anyone give the government credit for it?
I think just the absence of it.
Yeah.
Is to the benefit of Biden, right? I mean, the economy, there's every reason to believe that the economy is going to be doing well then.
I think employment will be good, hopefully. But I think the trends are all really good for employment. And actually, you know, that actually gets to what is bugging me here. This sounds like I'm changing the subject, but I just want to get this in. Like, in all of the blame game I'm seeing about Democrats' agenda being too progressive or too liberal, there's a strike wave happening in this country, and Democrats are doing nothing for labor.
Nothing.
They have for years. Their own campaign people know that when labor declines, Democratic vote share declines. You want to talk about the white working class? That's who you need to win back. There's a strike wave going on in the country. Democrats are not talking about it. They're not passing legislation addressing it. And it's not coming up in the postmortems. No one's bringing it up in the postmortems.
It also runs counter to the new kind of donor constituency that they're trying to covet.
They're like,
damn, do we really got to go back here? Because if they were just thinking about their electoral interests, yes, they would be leaning more into labor. But they've already gone down this path of upper middle class suburban voters, and I don't think they want to turn back, which is bad news.
And the strikes that we're seeing seem to me also to be sort of like, you know, an analogy to what we saw in Virginia, in that people have gone through a lot of like like a hell for the past 2 years. Mm-hmm. And they are going, they are literally, they are looking for payback, and they are looking for, you know, some form of reparation.
Yeah.
And if you are, you know, if you're a John Deere worker and John Deere is making record billions of dollars of profit, I mean, just obscene amounts of money, you're going like, you know what? Giving us a raise that you denied us over the past 10, 12 years, that ain't cutting it.
Yeah.
We, you know, yeah, I don't care what our union bosses say. It is time to pay back. But if you're a parent and you don't have the opportunity to strike, and somebody gives you a target, yep, and that is the, you know, a combination of the schools and like some toehold, which is they're teaching you that white people are bad. That we're going to see this across the sort of like, I think the terrain, it's going to manifest itself in ways that we like and manifest, yeah, itself in ways in that we don't like. And a political party has to take advantage of that.
Political party has to capitalize on that.
And they're not doing it. And the Democrats aren't doing it at all.
No, no, they're not. And that's the thing, because these moments are contestable, right? You determine, you know, the political actor has a major role in determining who is the target of this discontent. You got to pick a target. You got to pick a compelling target. You got to convince people that's the right target to go after. And Democrats aren't willing to, are unable and unwilling to do that.
They seem completely oblivious.
Yeah.
Wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, where we, you know, the filibuster, but I have a feeling that's not going to get resolved before your next visit. So
I think that'll still be on the table next time.
I think it'll still be on the table. So what do you think? I mean, do you think anybody's going to be talking about Virginia in 3 weeks? I mean, aside from like all the sort of retrograde things that may happen, I mean, I don't have a sense of what Youngkin's going to do, you know, in terms of like Democrats in Virginia.
You know, it's funny. I remember
over the past 2 years,
I remember Virginia elections dominating political discourse during the after Bush's reelection. I remembered like Virginia gubernatorial races, because of where the political media lives, have this huge outsized thing. And then like the governor gets elected, you never hear from him again, right? Like,
right.
You know, McAuliffe already governor for a while. Who knows what he did? I mean, he was a decent Democratic governor, surprisingly, but, you know, I don't think we'll be hearing nonstop about it much after this.
Alex Perrine, how can people find your the better of the APs that are out there?
The better AP, you can find it at theap.substack.com. That's my newsletter, the AP parentheses Alex Perrine, which is my name. You cannot have any legal argument against me using my own name. and Politics of Everything is a podcast I do with the New Republic, where I am also a contributing editor. But yeah, check out the AP.
So let me ask you this. This is one of my bailiwicks here. Why isn't anybody on Substack just buying a URL that says the AP Alex Perrine or whatever it is .com so that it just forwards there?
My answer is that I was too lazy to, I registered my own name and it redirects to my Substack, but I was too lazy to just set it up to be hosted there. I was too lazy for the hosting part of it as opposed to the redirect. But you know what? I will consider it.
Redirect is fine.
But Substack's not going to set up a link that doesn't have Substack in the title.
Oh yeah. Oh, no, you can get a URL and have it forward there.
I understand, but they want Substack in the title.
So,
all right. Your question was, why didn't Substack set it up?
So. I mean, no. My question was, why didn't people with Substacks do it?
Oh,
yeah. I mean, I get it that Perrine's getting like, you know, six figures Substack. It's he's may have specific. So, Alex Perrine, always a pleasure.
Yeah, always. Thank you, Sam and Emma.
Folks, that reminds me, Majority Live.
Yes.
MajorityLive.com is how you get tickets to the live show. MajorityLive.com. Oh, wait a second. I can't remember what Sam said. Did he say Majority Live or MajorityReportLive.com? Yeah, both of them work.
Boom.
There you go. Check it out right now. Go to your computer and just put in the URL majoritireportlive.com. Where does that take you? And then try majoritylive.com. Same place. That is January 16th. We have a live show in Boston at the Wilbur Theater. The guy from the Wilbur said to, well, not to me directly, but like, tickets are selling fast. And so
people, get them while they're hot.
You've been warned.
People want to watch something besides the Celtics, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Oof.
I know. I was like, a week ago, I was like, I got to get tickets to the Celts. Nets takes all down there. And now I'm like,
take your time on that.
I'll wait for the prices to drop. They drop, right? Like, they set the prices.
I mean, Nets tickets are unbelievably low right now anyway, for especially a contending team. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
They couldn't give them away during the playoffs last year.
It's fun.
When they looked like they were going to win the title, and Knicks tickets, like, you can't.
I went to a Nets game a couple years ago. It was really fun.
Yeah, super fun. And we could walk down there.
It doesn't matter what the Nets do. It doesn't matter if they win 3 rings in a row. This will always be a Knicks city, so enough.
We just got a really inappropriate I am. All right. Do you need to step out for a sec?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah,
why don't you step out while I go...
Get some IMs?
Yes. Well, I'm going to bring Matthew, film guy, in just a moment. But I just want to remind you, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And when you do, you not only support the free show, you get extra content. And right now, we are the Majority Report Brain Trust is huddling. And we're going to start like rolling out different features. We're going to be integrating the AM Quickie. You can find the AM Quickie at amquickie.com. Sign up for it. It is a newsletter that every morning. It's really fantastic. Corey and Jack do an amazing job every day. It is the first thing that I read it depends on when I get up, because sometimes I get a deal with the cats and the call and then the kids, but it's the first thing I read in the day, and they're doing a great job with it. I mean, really gives you a good sense of what's going on. Super easy read. Check it out, amquickie.com. Also, again, Majority Live, and if you want to join our Discord, majoritydiscord.com, and if you want to IM the show, majorityapp.com. So all those things, and we are, I think over the next like month or two, we're going to start to sort of like roll out some new features for members, start adding more and more bonus stuff for members. But again, it's a great way to support the show. And it is your support that keeps the show alive. We do not, we stopped drowning somehow in the Comcast money. We were able to save ourselves from the drowning. And so now it's all just our members essentially that support this program.
Yeah, it's just the Google folks that are directly.
Oh yeah, and that's true. Eric Schmidt comes over and makes my bed every morning. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe before we bring in Matthew Film Guy?
Yeah, patreon.com/leftreckoning. We've got a think tank for everybody, so that'll be going up for patrons this weekend. And we had a good episode with El Caracazanas putting the scale and cruelty of the American injustice system into proportion. So that was this week. Go subscribe to the YouTube channel.
Folks, let me also just point out one thing. You may see like I'm sort of fidgeting in a weird way today, and I got diagnosed with like a elbow problem, and I'm not supposed to be putting weight on this elbow, so I got to figure out, like, I'm thinking of maybe getting like some type of like thing that I can just push down on here so that I can support it like this, because I like to lean in.
Yep, just
I need like a handle here, just so that I'm going like this, because I'm not supposed to put it here because my fingers are numb.
That's your left.
Yeah.
What happened?
Don't know. Weird. Don't know. All right, let's bring in this guy, but it's going to involve the theme song. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been a while. Matthew, the film guy, is choosing a series. Cast of Babies on Netflix and other such things. Matthew Film Guy is here, ladies and gentlemen, in the house with, I think, what it appears to be a new... he's got some like new a posterage going on there, a Cassavetes film. Is it the I can't quite make it out. Is it the Mikey and Nikki? Is that what that is?
That's right. It's a holdover from a This Is Revolution special show I did a couple nights ago, where I extolled the virtues of Elaine May's masterpiece, Mikey and Nikki. So I thought I would roll it into this show. Why not? But first, I just want to say hello to you, Sam. Thank you for having me, you disgusting natalist scum.
Appreciate it. Appreciate your being here.
What's up, Matthew?
I am. Your views are up in the air. At least Sam's are on record, but same to you.
Yes, I'm keeping that ambiguous, obviously.
Sure.
Now
Sam is a two-time loser. Go on.
Tell us a little bit about like May and Cassavetes and that crew, because at least there's like a part of the Cassavetes crew there. Boy, you really were itching for this, weren't you?
Well, I've just been doing a deep dive of my own back into this. This is probably, full disclosure, my favorite film of all time. I mean, there's three or four that may vie for that title, but I was asked by Forrest Miller, who, used to edit Michael Brooks's movies and for Michael Brooks' show, and is doing his own podcast, the Movie Night Extravaganza. And he got invited to do this episode and asked me, what movie do you want to talk about? And Mikey and Nikki, I could talk about it for years, for months, for days, for hours. It sort of intersects with Cassavetes, who, as you know, is also one of my all-time favorites. It's sort of the reason why you and I met, because the Cassavetes scholar, Ray Carney, suggested I get to know you and so on. But Mikey and Nikki was actually written and directed by Elaine May, who you also know from her improv comedy background. She basically invented the art form in a lot of ways. She descended from Stanislavski method, Chicago school. And she had been wanting to make this movie for many, many years, which is supposedly based on a true life anecdote about gangsters that were in her family. And it's ostensibly a gangster movie, but it's two people played by Peter Falk and John Cassavetes. And you get to know their entire lives basically in one dark night of the soul as they're running from a hitman played by Ned Beatty. So it's sort of deceptively simple in its concept, but the characters are as well written as any that ever graced a screen. And it isn't improvised in the sense that any of the dialogue is improvised. Elaine May wrote the script, but Cassavetes and Falk's performances are like so genius. It's like a masterclass in subtext, performance, facial features, line readings, all of that stuff that's not actually on the page. So it's just an amazing movie that bears repeat viewing. And it's just one of my all-time favorites. And it has some similarities to Cassavetes' sort of worldview. And I could talk more about that if you'd like, but it's a great, great film. And it's very little seen. It's on the Criterion Channel, though, if people want to dig into it.
I want to hear more about Cassavetes' worldview in a second. But we should also say that I feel like Elaine May is probably one of the most underrated figures in comedy and film. I imagine it a big part of it has to be the fact that she was a woman particularly in that era. But she not only did masterpieces, you know, in terms of like film, but also I feel like, the comedy that she did, I still remember,
A little more gauze.
Yeah. Well, I had a video of Elaine May and Nichols like hosting.
Oh, the Emmys, their speech. Yes, I know. You love that. That's a great,
it was
great
fantastic movie. Where they came out in support of mediocrity in television and how it was completely underrated and no one, it's overlooked, and it really is the sort of foundation of what television had become, and not got nearly the credit that it deserved. And just like her comedy stuff was just really incredibly impressive. and completely underrated.
Yeah, I mean, listen, she at the time of this movie, she was only one of three women that were even in the Directors Guild in history. And, you know, she if she was a man, we'd be talking about how what an uncompromising artist she was, how she never, you know, gave in to the studios, how she fought for her vision. But instead, she got tarred as a difficult person to work with and was basically, you know, it's actually it's sort of like a story of what have you done for me lately? Because after this movie, the behind the scenes story of the making of this movie is as interesting as the movie itself in a lot of ways, because she basically had to like kidnap two reels of the film in order to get her final cut. And she like stashed it away. Supposedly the story is she's stored it at her therapist's house. They had private detectives looking for it. The studios did. So it was a really big blow up to find this, to finally get this movie made. And you know, she took a year and a half to edit it before she even showed the studio, you know, things that you just don't do when you're under a studio contract. You know, then they were like, we're never going to work with you again. Then she wrote an award-winning screenplay for the remake of Heaven Can Wait. And then they're like, oh, great. Yeah, here's another movie. And then, of course, that became Ishtar, which was celebrated as one of the greatest bombs of all time. And in reality, it's an actually really great movie, too. It's one of my favorite movies. Not quite as great as this one, but it was, you know, culturally sort of tarred as, you know, a horrible, horrible film before it even came out. Because the studio were leaking rumors about how over budget she was.
Yeah.
And, you know,
I remember that. That was like we don't see anything. I don't think there's ever been anything quite like that. Like the project of maligning that film as it was going on. Like there were sketches, I feel like, on Saturday Night Live mocking the movie before it came out.
Yeah,
Waterworld was the only other thing that I feel like had that type of run up, and it was like people were gunning for her, I think.
Yeah. And it was one of these things which, you know, it's so inside baseball, it's not really that interesting to me really in the end, but it's like a studio head switched in the middle of production, and, you know, a Warren Beatty was sort of her like consigliere for this because she had helped him on Reds, and then he had to go to bat for her and get her more time. And then, you know, when the studio heads switch, they don't want to like the project that the previous guy did. You know how it is, Sam.
Yes, I do.
But, you know, anyway, the point is Elaine May is definitely one of the unsung greatest artists of the 20th century. And it's, you know, it just, I want more people to see her work. You know, A New Leaf also got taken away from her. She didn't get the final cut. I still think it came out pretty great. She fought to try to get her name off of it. And Heartbreak Kid, that's the only one that had no problem because she only just directed that. She didn't write that. Neil Simon wrote that, and someone else edited it. But that makes Mikey and Nikki her like ultimate masterpiece. That's like hers from start to finish. And they actually shot over 1 million feet of film, which at the time it was like more footage than Gone with the Wind, you know? So she made the movie she wanted to make, even though she, you know, was extremely perfectionist about it, and it took forever, and it was worth it.
Talk about Cassavetes' worldview.
Okay, well, what I mean by that is, you know, these aren't, you know, people always tar his movies as like, oh, everyone's yelling, and there's a lot of extreme behavior, and they're horsing around, and it's like not realistic. But he kind of dealt with life at the extremes, you know, these things that we may have at our disposal to push against societal expectations. And this movie really is about two people. They're criminals, so they're sort of already in a special category. And the whole movie takes place like after midnight. So it's in that witching hour where normal rules of social behavior sort of start to melt away. But he always wanted things rough hewn. He always wanted things sketchy. He always wanted things kind of not staid, not cliche. There's no cliches in any of his movies or this movie. And it's sort of his worldview is, you know, it's all about investigating the individual's role in a society and what you give up by sort of going along to get along, what sort of death to the soul that might entail, but also what sort of madness you might be courting to, you know, continue to act in on your impulses. So that's, I think, what makes the movie so awesome, so exciting, but also so like sometimes hard to take.
Fair enough. All right. Well, that was a bit of a divergent now, but you went through this on
this movie is The Eternals by Marvel.
Well, no, wait a second. Wait a second. Before we get to that.
No.
You were on This Is Revolution.
Yes.
So folks can check that out.
Yeah, check that out. We talked about Conan Neutron and Forrest Miller, the two co-hosts of Movie Night Extravaganza, had me on it. We got into it a little bit with Mikey and Nikki. They both love it, too. So,
all right.
Feel free to follow me on Letterboxd, is what it's called. And we can talk movies all the time there if you want. And also on the Discord, the Majority Report Discord, we got some great conversations going on in the movie room there, too.
So Matthew, what have you been up to? Like, what is happening? Like, production's in full swing now, it seems like, right?
And yes, so things are happening. Well, the IATSE strike was for a second threatening to maybe slow things down.
But, they haven't voted yet.
They haven't voted yet. So that still could happen, but indie films, a lot of the stuff that I kind of go up for, not necessarily all, union shoots. So it's good news, bad news, as far as I'm concerned. But I've been taking a lot of meetings. I'll put it to you that way. A lot of stuff in the works. Nothing I can talk about quite yet. I'm waiting back on a couple things. But yeah.
So, what we're hearing,
I guess the fanfare will come when I actually get it, right? Okay,
Of course. No, it's intrigue. Yeah. That you just gave us intrigue, not celebration.
I'm celebrating having meetings. Give me a break.
That's incidentally how you should walk into a room.
I can bring you with me. That would be great.
So this is, we're watching, this is like Black Bear payoff time.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, listen, making that movie was its own reward. So I don't like to speak in terms of that kind of a payoff and that sort of mercenary terms, but yes. I didn't do it for the money or the fame or the acclaim, but you know, when they all came, I said, okay.
No. Yes. No. But, I mean, are you walking into rooms and people are going, Black Bear was great?
Yes. That's the only reason they want to talk to me, obviously. Yes. Sometimes they say, I see you had a small role in A Bad Situationist, but we'll talk to you anyway. No, they don't say that.
They don't bring up Pilot Season?
I know. I think I did a much better job. I had more lines in that one. I mean, I'm just glad I survived the presence of a bazooka on the set of Bad Situationist.
But all right. We're not going to talk about that. That one I don't feel like talking about.
I understand. Me neither. But I've been doing that kind of thing and, keeping the movie class going too, which is still available. Go to my Twitter and join us on Tuesdays at noon where we talk about movies every week.
So this is great. So you're going in on meetings about editing. Are you getting any, maybe somebody saying like, hey, do you do any directing?
No, not yet. Not yet. Let's see. Let's get a couple more editings under my belt and then we'll talk about that. Because I feel like I do bring the full package to the table. I mentioned that I've done it in the past and that I've written. So that's kind of, I'm a well-rounded editor.
Now, just give everybody like a little insight into this. Obviously, we don't want to jinx anything. We don't want to put anything, but when you go in for meetings, are you meeting with producers? Are you meeting with directors? Are you meeting with agents? Like, who is it that you meet with? What stage in the production do you go in? Give us an insight of like what a soon to be major motion picture editor life is like as he or she is looking for work.
It's different on different films. I've talked to sometimes the producer first and they sort of, give me a brief little shakedown and like, here's what it is and what's going on. Very frequently they'll send me the script first and I'll read it. And then I'll decide like, okay, I like it. One or two scripts I read and even though I can't be too choosy, I was like, I don't know if I could really spend 9 months working on this. So, it gets past that point. I read the script, I turn it right around and then it's often the producer first. And then if that goes well, I've had a couple of Zooms with the director, the guy that I'm actually going to be working with. And, those are, that's the final stage negotiation. We see if we hit it off. Some of them last 10 minutes. Some of them go an hour and a half. So
now
we'll see how it goes.
Do you come in after reading a script and you come in and you say, I see this as being very fast paced, or I see this, the editing reminds me of this, or are you talking about story? I mean, what is it like? you know,
I try to, I know what you're getting at. I try to keep it kind of high level, and I sort of feel out from the other person what they are in the mood to hear, because I know some directors, like, they don't want to hear, oh, this reminds me of this movie meets that movie. And some of them, I've wound up finding out they did. Like, oh, yeah, that helps me. Okay, yeah, this movie. Oh, I haven't seen that one. I'll watch that. And so, you know, it's like a grab bag.
Are you pitching technical skill, or are you pitching understanding of story?
I'm pitching understanding of story, and I'm sort of pitching confidence in the delivery of a cut on time. That's also what I'm realizing. It's like, you know, we only have 6 weeks, because these are kind of lowish budget movies. And, you know, I sort of talk about my process, how much note taking I want to do ahead of time, you know, and they ask me, do you want to sit with me for everything? Do you want to go off on your own for a while and come back with something? And for the record, I do prefer to do like my own cut first, and then the director comes in and gives notes. But I can work both ways. I've worked with the worst frame fuckers in the business, where they're just like, go this way, go that way. And I've been left alone. So I'm basically just pitching myself as an overall competent editor. So all that stuff gets touched on.
And you have to come off as sort of somewhat, you know, likable, because you're going to be spending a lot of time with this person.
Oh, I forgot that. I forgot to do that. Yeah, no, I have to do that. Yeah, definitely. It's like some of them have been very friendly. We've actually seemed to be like, you know, we could get along. Some of them have been a little bit more business. But yeah, for sure. That's all part of it, you know, because you are it's like a therapist in a way.
Are any of these comedies? Like, how do you establish, like, I get comedy or something like that? Or is it drama or what?
My agents actually did want to include some of the stuff. Like, I did Ted Alexandro's Teacher's Lounge web series, and some of the little shorts that I did with you guys and Marin and stuff are in there. So they at least are aware that I have a...
you've been around comedians.
Penchant for comedy in that sense, too. But for the most part, right now, the things that I've been getting are like Black Bear, you know, like... dramas sort of with a horror-ish tone.
Oh, wait, was that a drama?
Did you see it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a comedy drama that's sold as a horror.
Yes, no, I get
I mean, that's what's funny about Mikey and Nikki, actually, is that it people went into it thinking Elaine May, it must be a comedy, and it really kind of is. It's like the blackest of black comedies of all time. So that's kind of my wheelhouse, is comedies that are really dramas, or vice versa.
All right. Well, this has been, you know, what I liked about this segment, and we haven't even gotten to your suggestion yet, but what I like about this segment, aside from what we learned about, you know, Elaine May and, Mikey and Nikki, is we have an insight to what it's like to be an editor looking for work coming out of a pandemic when things are starting to heat up, particularly with low budget, and there's suspense. Because it's possible next time we have Matthew Film Guy on, you're going to have a job.
You're gonna get booked, yeah.
Oh, all right. From your mouth to the god of Hollywood's ears, or IndieWood, sure.
On wood.
And with that said, I should also tell you, that Peacock thing, that's not happening.
Great. I was counting on that.
6 months to see if he was going to be doing some of the editing.
Riding our coattails.
7-8 months.
Huh?
Yeah.
No. Now
I should have given you a heads up earlier. That's not happening.
I may have put that together when I saw that ridiculous shirt you're wearing.
What, without the collar? Are you saying? Yeah.
No. You look great. You look really great.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That's very nice of you to say, Matthew. What do you have for us this weekend, Matthew?
Well, once you get done watching Mikey and Nikki and you're in the mood for something else,
I should also have you, in the future, you should come out like one for the kids and one for the adults.
Because I was thinking that. What's that, Emma?
One for different moods. So you need to pick me up. Say you want a drama.
Well, then you got to go to his letterbox.
Oh, right. Sorry.
On my letterbox, you'll see some of the absolute drivel that I subject myself to in my spare time, too. So you can always see, you know, how I feel about some of the recent releases or some old silly movies, too.
It's okay. I watched Half Baked the other weekend. So it's
you not, did?
Yeah.
That was written in my apartment.
Oh, it really?
Yeah. Are you serious?
Are you joking?
Yeah. No, in the apartment in Who's the Caboose? In L.A., Neil Brennan at one point was my roommate, and he and Chappelle wrote it in the other room.
Wow.
It was about your apartment, I thought, right?
No, it was not about my apartment. Okay.
That was like the ultimate sleepover movie when I was a kid.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
I always rented it.
the sleepover. Good parents. Yeah. So actually the movie that I want to tell people about this week is an English film, and it's from the early 90s, and it is called Distant Voices, Still Lives. Have you ever heard of it, Sam?
I have not.
Okay, it's Terrence Davies, who had done, I think, a couple other films at this